From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, looks like Michigan's got itself a nearly $1 billion budget windfall.
We'll be hearing about tax cuts a lot over the course of the next several months.
I think at the end of the day, taxpayers are going to see a little bit more change in their pocket.
Writer Mitch Albom considers miracles in his latest book, The First Phone Call from Heaven.
If you have a little miracle happen to you, is it your obligation to prove to the rest of the world that it's a miracle, or is it enough that it happened to you?
The North American International Auto Show. 26 years ago, it wasn't a big deal.
It was pretty unimportant, except to the local dealers. It was pretty much a local show that was intentionally created for January when in the middle of winter when things were slow.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Monday. Hundreds of thousands of people will be descending on Detroit beginning this week for the North American International Auto Show. But the show wasn't always such a big deal. This hour, we find out about the history of the Detroit Auto Show and how it came to be such a huge event. And then author and columnist Mitch Albom has a new book out. We'll talk to him about his novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven, later in the show. But first, here's a pleasant problem occupying minds in Lansing. What do you do with a projected budget surplus of $971 million? Well, as one might expect with anything that comes out of Lansing, there is no shortage of debate on just what to do with this windfall. We're joined now by Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and Jonathan Osting, MLive's Lansing reporter. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, I'll start with you. Almost $1 billion in surplus. What's behind this?
Well, we have a lot more money, and I think just the biggest question is what we're going to do with it. But we're seeing it from a lot of different avenues. A lot of this is one-time money. It's from unwinding the Michigan business tax, and so that's part of it, and that complicates, you know, what you can do with it, because you get into this argument of one-time money versus, you know, perpetual income that's coming in. So there are a lot of different corners, and now the fight begins as to how to spend it or give it back.
I guess, Jonathan, some people might go, hey, did the government simply overcharge us? Is there any of that behind this windfall?
Yeah, well, certainly that is the case. I mean, a lot of the unexpected revenue last year was income tax revenue. It was from apparently the fiscal cliff. A lot of people who had invested decided to claim capital gains or dividends at the end of 2012, which is part of fiscal year 2013, and paid taxes on those. So there was a little unexpected bump in the income tax. And, you know, that's certainly one of the most popular ideas right now, is to look at the income tax and to say, you know, Michigan residents have paid for this surplus and they deserve to get a little relief as a result.
Well, let's break down what different ideas are floating around Lansing for spending this $971 million projected windfall. Chris, start with what you see as the main ideas.
Well, one of them is one that Senator Brandenburg has been really pushing, and that's lowering the income tax rate incrementally back down to what it was back in 2000 when it was raised to fix a budget problem. That is something that the Republicans and Governor Snyder stopped in the massive legislation in 2011, when we got rid of the Michigan business tax and created the corporate income tax, and we got rid of all the deductions. We also froze the staged decline in the income tax rate, and so they're trying to bring that back and start bringing that back down. There are some who are on board with that. There are others who are nervous about doing that because they don't want to see in a few years that becoming another problem where you've got to raise it back up again. And so that'll be the fight. That's one of the big ones. We've also heard talk of some type of rebate. I think at the end of the day, your taxpayers are going to see a little bit more change in their pocket. The question is, you know, how much of will that be, and will it just be pocket change?
Now, Jonathan, your take.
Yeah, one other idea I've heard mentioned briefly, but not in any great detail, is some sort of looking at property tax relief. But certainly the income tax cut was the sort of initial response, but that's being tempered right now. Because, you know, this $970 million surplus, as Chris mentioned, about $325 million of that is like recurring money, so like a baseline budget that the state can sort of input this year and expect expect in future years going forward. But the majority of that, about two-thirds of that surplus, is actually just one-time money. So when you talk about a gradual income tax rate reduction, you know, the budget impact of that would be larger each year as the tax rate continues to go down. So the rebate idea seems to be gaining a little bit of favor. But as Chris mentioned, the state doesn't want to be in a position where they're sending out checks for, you know, $12 and say, hey, look at us, we're giving you $12. So
sure.
They want to make sure they can actually give residents something substantial so, you know, it doesn't become, I guess, sort of laughable.
I think you could also say that, you know, this is an election year, so any amount of money that they're giving taxpayers back isn't really the question. It's can you put on a flyer that you stick in somebody's mailbox that, you know, I gave you a tax cut. And this is the hope that people will forget the tax increases that were foisted upon them in 2011 with, you know, getting rid of all the deductions that so many people utilized and freezing the income tax rate and some of the other things. One thing that you're going to hear, I think, from the Michigan Municipal League and some other groups is with this whole idea of the personal property tax elimination. Right now, there's only an 80% return on that money to local municipalities, and so there's going to be a case to be made especially by the local government groups to say, give us 100% funding. You know, that's one way. Instead of giving everybody, like Jonathan said, $12 back,
mm-hmm.
give it back and let's fully fund and hold harmless our local municipalities so we can keep firefighters and police officers on the streets when this personal property tax goes away, if voters have it in August. So that could be one way to spend some of that money is to have fully fund that revenue.
And I have to imagine somewhere in this conversation that the issue of infrastructure and our roads has to be a player.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the state did put some one-time money into roads, and they'll have the opportunity to do so again this year. I mean, the governor still seems unlikely to get anything close to the $1.2 billion in new revenue that he had originally proposed. But certainly roads are going to be part of this discussion. Budget Director John Nixon said on Friday, you know, they want to look at K-12 and higher ed budgets as well as public safety. Those are things he specifically mentioned. So, you know, he said take care of some of those strategic budget priorities first, and then we'll talk about a tax relief. He did call tax relief of some form inevitable, so it's going to happen, but there will be some other spending priorities as well.
Chris, what does Governor Snyder appear to want to do with this windfall?
I think that'll be something that we might see in the State of the State address. One of the things we finally got a hard answer out of him in what he doesn't want to do, and he does not want to repeal the pension tax, I think, is to do with some of this money. State employees will argue, you know, you should be giving that some of that money back to state workers. We haven't heard him, you know, while other people are getting raises, you know, the state workers may or may not be getting this 2% raise. We haven't heard a lot of what he wants to do with it. He never opens up the playbook, obviously, more so than the most, but it'll be a real question, I think, as to what he wants to do with it. But whatever he's going to do, it's going to be very fiscally sound in his mind. So that's why he's not jumping on board the let's just cut taxes bandwagon to a drastic amount and then have a problem later on. He looks at things in 5, 10, 20-year budget cycles, you know, the way most people don't. So whatever he does, he's going to have a very good case to be made behind it.
As you say, kind of expect to hear some of that on Thursday's State of the State address.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it would make sense for him because, like Jonathan said, when Budget Director Nixon said that a tax cut is inevitable, probably it wouldn't be too, it would probably be pretty smart for him to get out in front of this into a larger audience that maybe just now be hearing about this for the first time that, hey, there's this money out there. What better place to talk about this tax cut and make people think it's your idea than the State of the State address?
Sunday's Free Press had a commentary piece from House Speaker Bolger, and the headline was Why State's Surplus Must Go to Tax Cut, promising also the GOP won't neglect education and roads in the process. So, Jonathan, what are we hearing from the GOP leaders in the House and Senate?
Well, exactly that. I mean, nobody's really backed any one specific proposal yet. It's very early. House Speaker Bolger also met with reporters last week and said, you know, as you did in your lead, this is a good problem to have, and we're going to enjoy debating it. And as Chris mentioned, it's an election year, so more debate over a tax cut, what form that should take, isn't necessarily a bad thing for them because it keeps tax cuts in the headlines. So, you know, I don't don't know if there will be any quick resolution of this. There doesn't have to be until they finish the budget. The governor's going to present his budget in early February, and that's probably when the talks will pick up a little more. But we'll be hearing about tax cuts a lot over the course of the next several months.
And Chris, what do we hear from Democrats? In fact, do they even have a prayer of getting any of the money for things they want?
I think they do, which is kind of a weird answer given the last 3 years track record.
But, yeah.
But some of the things that they're always going to be pushing for is things for seniors, things for education. And in a lot of respects, these are things that the governor and the Republicans cut in 2011. And so now that this is an election year, now is the time to sort of put some of that back in. And so I think you're going to see talk about education funding, you know, in the State of the State address, and you're going to see talk about seniors. I mean, like, he's not going to repeal the pension tax, but the governor has talked about having a special message on seniors and coming up with some things. There's some things he wants to do with mental health. The lieutenant governor and Director Haveman of Community Mental Health have been working on this report that he hopes to have some actionable items that maybe we'll hear about on Thursday. So I think there's going to be some things that he's going to talk about that the Democrats are going to like because they're great election year issues to campaign on.
All right, here's a jump ball question. Is there any argument for not using up all of or part of this the projected surplus? Would it not be a good thing to have a good chunk of money in the kitty for security for when things go into another down cycle?
Well, certainly, the rainy day fund has grown quite a bit under the governor, and I imagine they'll put a little more in that fund this time around. Snyder, when we asked him about the idea of tax cuts last week, his response was to point out that he's a CPA, so he's always thinking long term, thinking ahead, and he's been a big proponent of investing in that rainy day fund to sort of prepare for any budget anomalies that might occur down the line. Sure.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if there wasn't some of this money that goes into the rainy day fund. Anytime there's any sort of excess, I think the governor's been pretty successful in getting some of that put into the rainy day fund, so I don't see this being any different.
That was Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and he was joined by Jonathan Osting, MLive's Lansing reporter. Thank you so much for talking with us today, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What if the end is not the end? That's likely the most oft-asked question in the depths of our hearts, especially when death claims someone dear to us, or when we stop to think of the years ticking by and we wonder how much time is left for us. And that question is at the heart of the latest book by Mitch Albom, The First Phone Call from Heaven. It tells the story of the town of Coldwater, Michigan. It's a fictional story. A handful of people begin receiving phone calls from people who have died. Are these phone calls from the afterlife or a big nasty hoax? Mitch Albom, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I read The First Phone Call from Heaven, and I'll tell you, I did it in the context, Mitch, of having lost my mother-in-law earlier this year. So she was the last of our four parents to die. And although I can still hear their voices in my memory saying certain things in their own ways, boy, you know, what we would all give to really hear from those loved ones on the other side talking to us in real time. Where did this idea come for you?
Well, in its own weird way, it was a little similar to what you just said. My mother suffered a couple of major strokes about 3.5 years ago when I began to conceive this book, and they robbed her of the ability to speak. And I have not heard her voice since then. And it's been 3.5 years since she said a word to me.
Boy.
And, you know, I grew up with a very, very loquacious mother. So to all of a sudden have that voice stop was really very stunning. And while she's still alive, I can hold her hand, look at her. I'm not sure she knows if it's me or not. But to not hear that voice is to lose the essence of who she was. And I began to notice how people saved answering machine messages when people died, just to hear their voice saying, let's go to Costco tomorrow, or I'll meet you at 8 at the restaurant, you know, little mundane sentences. It was the sound of the voice. And so I began to explore in the novel, well, what happens if I created a world where those voices were heard again, but they were from the other side, and they sort of validated that there was a heaven. How would that make people feel? And I sort of took off from there.
Mitch, you've said you hope that readers will take away from your book the idea that we are really missing something if we're not paying attention to those small miracles that happen all around us rather than seeking the one big, huge miracle. Tell us more about how you expand on that in your book.
not to assume that anybody knows what the book is about. Right. It's a small town in northern Michigan. One day wakes up, the phones start ringing, people calling from heaven. Only it only happens to a handful of people, and it only happens in this small town. And the book follows what happens when the story leaks out to the rest of the country and the world, and people start descending on this little town in the middle of nowhere. They bring their phones. They all want to be part of this miracle. Everybody, you know, that's one reaction to a miracle, is everybody says, why not me?
Yes.
And where's my share of it?
Sure.
Then the media gets involved with it, and they turn it into a big story. And meanwhile, there's sort of the protagonist of the book is this guy named Sully, who's kind of a broken man. He was in prison for something he didn't really do. His wife died while he was in prison, and he's got nothing good to think about the world. He has no belief in anything. And his 7-year-old son comes home one day from school with a toy phone, and he says, Daddy, when is Mommy going to call us?
Boy.
And he realizes that the town has now infiltrated even his son's mind, and he sets out to prove that the whole thing is a hoax. And, of course, I use this character to basically be the voice of doubt in the book. As the miracle's getting bigger and bigger, he's digging deeper, deeper, deeper. He seems to be coming onto some clues as to what might be happening. And meanwhile, the thing gets so big that it's going to culminate with a planned for broadcast a few days before Christmas of the first actual live phone call from heaven, where the whole world is going to be listening in or watching on TV or watching on computers, and this call is scheduled to come, and they're going to hear a voice from the other side, just as it seems like he's sort of cracked the code as to what's going on.
Yeah.
So the idea of a miracle, as you asked me, was to explore, if you have a little miracle happen to you, is it your obligation to prove to the rest of the world that it's a miracle, or is it enough that it happened to you? If I talk to somebody, as has happened many times in my life, because when you write the book Tuesdays with Maury, you're going to meet a lot of people who want to share grieving stories with you. And I've heard this story in some form. Oh, I was in my daughter's bedroom a year after she died. I was crying. I was sitting on her bed. I missed her so much. Suddenly, a photograph of the two of us fell off the bureau, and it landed by my feet. And I know that that was her. Yeah. She was sending me a sign that we were okay. She was sending me a sign. I know it was her. Now, I could bring in 10 physicists who could explain why a picture falls off a bureau at a particular time, some vibration of the earth, whatever it is. Won't matter.
Mm-mm.
To that woman, that's what it was. That was the miracle. And who's to say she's wrong?
You're right.
That's my point. You know, if it's a miracle to her, it's a miracle. That's a good enough reason.
Boy, in effect, as you say that, I had that very thing happen with my late father's fire helmet. He was a fire captain in Ferndale. And I know exactly what you're talking about. We were all standing around. It was up on top of a bookcase. Nobody bumped the bookcase, and suddenly it came down, boom. And someone said, he's letting you know he's there. And you're right. I'm not going to challenge that. I'm accepting that miracle. And it seems that that has certainly been something you've realized in your life.
Well, I happen to be a person who unashamedly believes in small miracles every day. I am overwhelmed and in a constant state of amazement at the gift of life and the various forms that it takes. I've been blessed to see a lot of the world and conditions in parts of the world where you couldn't even believe that someone could ever smile again, and yet see people smiling and see children happy. I've had experiences happen to me that I should have been dead and walked away from. I've had fortune come my way in Tuesdays with Maury, the book, to see my professor on television one night and happen to just flip the channel and happen to write a book that I can't just explain away by coincidence or luck. It feels to me like something much bigger is at play in the universe, and I believe that that manifests itself in people's lives many different times. There's a paragraph in the book that says, you know, miracles happen every day. The appearance of a person at an accident scene all of a sudden, someone who happens to sail by when someone falls off a boat, all these kinds of things that we just say, boy, wasn't that lucky? Well, was it lucky, or was it, you know, somebody watching out for us? And so I have no problem writing books about little miracles that happen. I've written them a couple times now.
Yes.
And it's how I feel my life is gone.
Would you read us an excerpt, maybe your favorite excerpt from the first phone call from heaven?
Well, I'll read you the first page because it sort of sets the tone of the book. It begins with the chapter heading, The Week It Happened. On the day the world received its first phone call from heaven, Tess Rafferty was unwrapping a box of tea bags. Ring. She ignored the ring and dug her nails into the plastic. Ring. She clawed her forefinger through the bumpy part on the side. Ring. Finally, she made a rip, then peeled off the wrapping and scrunched it in her palm. She knew the phone would go to answering machine if she didn't grab it before one more ring. Hello. Too late. Ah, this thing, she mumbled. She heard the machine click on her counter as it played her outgoing message. Hi, it's Tess. Leave your name and number. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. A small beep sounded. Tess heard static. And then, it's Mom. I need to tell you something. Tess stopped breathing. The receiver fell from her fingers. Her mother died 4 years ago.
That's Mitch Albom reading the opening words from his newest novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. So it begins with phone calls like these coming to just a few people in this town, and word quickly spreads. You show us people who really want to believe these calls come from heaven. They're out praying in public, praying on lawns, hoping for their own calls. And then you show us those who really do not believe. They're out protesting. They're calling out the chosen few and saying they're manipulators and liars. It seems you've put your finger directly on both sides of a question that humans have wrestled with since we first walked the earth.
Well, I like to explore the idea of if heaven really was proven, at least in some people's minds, how would it change people's behavior? Because this is the great mystery, as you said, this is the question that people have asked since the dawn of time. What comes next? If you really honestly had some proof, how would that change your behavior? And this is what I explore, as you point out, sometimes people come and protest because they don't want to believe that there really could be something next, because then they might have to change their ways. And some of the people in the book do exactly that. They start straightening up their act. They start going to church more often. They start asking for forgiveness. They start planning for the other side. Some people who have terminal illnesses no longer battle them the same way that they did because they feel, all right, this is just a passage now. It's not giving up of everything. Think about how people would really change their behavior if they truly accepted that there was someplace else. And of course, the very religious amongst us who believe this fervently in their heart, and also some people who have had those near-death experiences where they've come back, they do have an interesting calm about them. If you've spent time with them or talked to them, they do have this sort of, I'm not all that worried about the things that everybody else is worried about. And I'm kind of fascinated by that. So I tried to explore it from both sides.
You know, I have to ask you to talk a little more about something you referenced, and that was the media madness, and, you know, starting with the local TV reporter hauling her own camera, looking for that big story to get her to the major market. And then it blows up to the network media circus. And boy, was it relatable as it spilled out. And oh, we're going to have that big live broadcast and the big story. And, you know, you look at that carnival, and I guess you and I can both say over the years we have probably played a role in that. Do you ever see this cycle of media madness abating where the public may say, you know, enough already? We know we're being played.
Boy, I wish the public would be that smart. I worry for the future of this business that I and you have chosen. You're right. I'm very cynical in this book about the media's handling of this. And sadly, I think I'm also accurate. I think if a story like this broke, where a town claimed to be getting phone calls from heaven and there seemed to be something to it, this is exactly what would happen.
Absolutely.
TV stations would descend on it. Everybody would kind of fan out and try to find their particular person and guard them from anyone else talking to them. There'd be all kinds of exclusives. There'd be interviews with experts decrying it or trying to prove it. There'd be people hanging around outside the porches of these people's houses. And nobody would seek any perspective.
No.
They would just want to milk it for as long as it goes. And at one point, probably the most sort of hard-edged or sarcastic moment in the book with regard to the media comes when they're about to do this broadcast of this live phone call from heaven. And the night before, the mayor of this small town starts to worry about what if it doesn't come, all these people. Now there's thousands of people in the town, and there's cameras everywhere, and the whole world is watching. And he says to the producer of this TV special, what if the call doesn't come? And the producer just rolls his eyes and said, what does that matter? And the mayor can't understand. You know, how could? What do you mean, what does it matter? Isn't that the whole point? And basically the producer says, it doesn't matter if the call comes or not, as long as they keep watching. You know, and that's sort of the truth of what, sadly, our business has become at its worst, which is we really don't care if we're reporting the truth. We really don't care if we have any perspective on anything. We really don't care if we're being fair to people, as long as we're bringing people in under the tent.
I'm talking with Mitch Albom about his new novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. And, you know, Mitch, in your acknowledgement at the end of The First Phone Call from Heaven, you write, and I'll quote here, this book was written with God's grace, lots of coffee, a morning table by a Michigan window, and love from family and friends. It was birthed at a difficult time, and many people helped me through that. I was wondering, can you share anything about what was going on for you, and did writing this book help you out?
It's sort of personal, so I can't, unfortunately, tell you a lot of details of that. But I can say that the writing of this book, which took place every morning, my routine of writing is very predictable. It's the first thing I do every morning. I get up, have a cup of coffee. My wife is usually up ahead of me. We sit down, say a few prayers, talk for a couple minutes, and then I go downstairs. There's no phone calls. There's no newspapers. There's no radio. There's no input of any kind. The first time I turn my brain on is to try to create the sentences for my books. And during this difficult time, it was an absolute refuge for me. And I would sometimes hide and stay down there for hours, just not wanting to stop writing, because stopping writing meant that I had to deal with the rest of the world and the things that I was dealing with. And so this book, more than anything that I've written, traversed that period of time and became a sanctuary. And I really realized how deeply in love I am with the craft of writing, not just because I like the physical act of it, or I like reading in the end what you produce, but because it's a safe place for me. It became a place that I built around myself and then crawled inside. And it's never quite been like that before. So I have a revitalized passion for writing because of what it provided for me during this tough time, which, by the way, has ended.
Okay.
You know, the difficulties they're finally now all behind me, and we've come through them. But, I hope you respect the fact
absolutely.
That I don't want to go into the details of
them. You know, as you're out doing book signings and making appearances for the first phone call from Heaven, what are you hearing from people? What do you think they're hoping to find when they seek out this story?
Almost always it's I wish I could have a phone call like this. In fact, sometimes they ask me to write that inside the book to, you know, Lenny, your phone call is coming. To Genevieve, wait one day, you'll hear from Larry, you know. To Larry, you know, never forget Genevieve, you know, you might get a phone call one day. Even though, obviously, the conceit of a phone call is almost feels, you know, a little corny. They're not talking about a phone call. They're talking about seeing them again or hearing from them again.
Let me know you're there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. As even you mentioned during our interview, and it doesn't surprise me, because I've become acutely aware ever since writing Tuesdays with Maury, and that now is 17 years, how much grieving goes on, how much yearning and longing for lost loved ones goes on every single day inside of people who are working right alongside you, who are eating at the subway right next to you, who are walking into the movie theater right next to you, who you might assume, well, they look like they're just going about life. They don't look like they're in pain. They don't look like they're missing anything. Peel that onion. Get into one of these conversations. And with me, they happen pretty quickly because people relate to me that way.
Yeah.
And you will be astonished at how many people go through life every day wishing that they could hear from someone else again, or missing someone so much that they're crying on the inside even as they're taking your order behind the counter, or filing a report, or standing in a courtroom, or whatever the case may be. It is just such a common human emotion, And I see it when people get this book. The title of this book alone has people picking it up and embracing it because of what they want in their own lives.
The book is The First Phone Call from Heaven, the latest novel by Mitch Albom. And Mitch is making appearances, a series of them, to support the book. And you can go to MitchAlbom.com and get the schedule and find out about all his charities and all of his other work. And Mitch, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking so much time with me. And I look forward to doing it again.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The North American International Auto Show is underway in Detroit with the media preview days leading up to Friday night's big charity preview and then the public opening on Saturday. One hometown automaker is already a big winner. It was announced this morning that General Motors swept the North American Car and Truck of the Year awards. The Chevrolet Silverado was honored as the top truck, and the Corvette Stingray was named the North American Car of the Year. Mark Royce is the outgoing president of GM North America, and he said the honors prove that Detroit is making quality cars again and people are starting to notice.
This industry is all about momentum, either in a sales or product basis. And, you know, you get people in the company that believe that we can win again, and we demonstrate that here over a couple of years, and we keep demonstrating it. You know, success breeds success.
This week's opening of the auto show marks the 25th year since the show took its jump into the big time. What used to be the Detroit Auto Show became the North American International Auto Show in 1989, and that put Detroit square in the center of the auto show universe. Detroit Free Press business columnist Tom Walsh looked into just what it took to make that happen. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Cindy.
So set the stage for us. How important, or should I say unimportant, was the old Detroit Auto Show?
It was pretty unimportant, except to the local dealers. It was pretty much a local show that it was intentionally created for January, when in the middle of winter, when things were slow, to try to gin up a little interest in the local market, so people would maybe buy a few cars instead of waiting for spring.
So it really didn't draw attention from elsewhere. And what was the competition? What were the bigger shows?
Well, the three bigger shows in the United States were New York, which was and is a fairly sizable show, Chicago, which has McCormick Place, mm-hmm. and much nicer facility and bigger facility right on the lake, and had always drawn more people, and L.A. And all these shows were bigger back 25 years ago. We're talking 1989. In the 70s and 80s, Americans had started to buy foreign cars, especially Asian, Japanese foreign cars, in fairly substantial numbers, and nowhere was that more evident than out in California. So L.A., the L.A. show had sort of gotten this cachet as a place for the international brands to display, and Chicago and New York got the bulk of the new model introductions from the big three for this market. And Detroit was sort of kind of an afterthought.
Yeah, kind of sounds very parochial. So who hatched the idea of making Detroit's the North American International Auto Show?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who claim to have been there. You know, it's kind of like, whether or not you saw the Beatles, you know, when they were
at Olympia in 64. You got it.
But there were several key players. One was Heinz Prechter, who is actually 12 years gone now.
Yeah,
was a brilliant German entrepreneur, the founder owner of American Sunroof Company. But he was a German born guy, kind of a citizen of the world, and was very familiar with the big foreign shows in Frankfurt and Geneva, Switzerland, and Paris,
mm-hmm.
and he was active in the Detroit community. He was also he's a political fundraiser for both President Bush's, so he was plugged into a lot of people. And he had heard that he saw Coleman Young, when Coleman was mayor of Detroit, had cut a deal with the legislature to expand COBO. And this is what created the hotel-motel tax, and I think there was a liquor tax.
Yes.
That went along with that for that COBO expansion back in the 80s. And the legislature actually passed it in 85, and they actually started getting going on it around 87. It wasn't finished until the time of the 89 show. But when they heard that Cobo was going to have almost double the exhibit space, Heinz thought, you know, this could be a, you know, this is, it could compete globally. Detroit had the name as the auto capital, and that we could compete globally with some of these other shows if we got all the car companies bought into the idea. And so he went, he called up Emmett Moten, who was then Coleman Young's economic development director, and said, I need an appointment with the mayor, and I want to bring the Super Bowl to Detroit. Well, at that time, the football Super Bowl was played out, you know, football was played in Pontiac back then.
Yeah, we had the Super Bowl there in 82.
Right, yeah. And we didn't, it was Ford Field wasn't even a gleam in anybody's eye at that point in Detroit.
Sure.
And Coleman and Emmett Moten wondered what this crazy German guy was talking about, bringing a Super Bowl to Detroit. So, but he took the appointment anyway, and Heinz said, you know, this Detroit could be, you know, this thing attracts more journalists than a Super Bowl, and it does, actually, 5,000 or 6,000 journalists from around the world come in, and it would be a huge boon to the community and a bright, shining star for Detroit, and he just used Super Bowl as an analogy. So he was one of the first. There were a couple of key auto dealers with the Detroit Auto Dealers Association who puts on the show. One was David Fisher, who is still the owner, the primary owner of the Suburban
Sure.
collection in Metro Detroit, and Ken Mead of the Mead Group, another guy with lots of dealers. And Ken had Toyota and Lexus, the Lexus franchise for the new Toyota luxury line that they were going to introduce.
They had
Lexus
these...
and Infiniti did their worldwide debuts in 89, and they did them in Detroit. So that was a big deal to get the foreign press here.
But I'm interested whether, did it take some cajoling to get the big three on board with this? Because there they would have to be sitting cheek by jowl at Cobo right next to those Japanese competitors.
Well, exactly. And there was still, you know, a bit of, you know, reluctance to play nice with, you know, companies that, you know, Lee Iacocca was still, you know, pounding his fist on the table about unfair trade practices
right.
And everything at the time. So there was, but on the other hand, GM also had a partnership with Toyota and the old NUMMI plant out in California. So they were starting to realize that, hey, this is a global industry. We play globally. We all have operations in Europe, and this is happening. So, why let other cities reap the benefits of good shows? So the big three got on board, and they talked about, you know, how much money they all had to kick in. So there was a little niff-gnawing about that. And but eventually they got it going, and you know, they said, okay, we're going to call this thing the North American International Show. And we in the press here kind of said, well, okay. And I was the business editor at the time, fairly new in my job.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy named Paul Leinart was my auto writer, and Paul is now head of the Reuters Bureau in Detroit, and it was sort of a goofy thing. So Paul had a little familiarity and said, well, you know, I don't know how this thing really competes with Geneva or Paris or Frankfurt, but, you know, it'll be a nice try. And so instead of the usual 100 journalists that they would get from the Detroit area and, you know, local papers
sure.
and whatnot, they got almost 1,000. They got like 970 from around the world. And then in subsequent years, as it grew more, you know, they got it up. Yeah, 1 year they had 9,000 until they realized they had too many.
It was too much.
Journalists. And they were a little too lax on the definition of a journalist. And there were all kinds of people sneaking in there with press passes.
And eating great food at the Mercedes exhibit.
Well, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And at first they didn't have those big, nice double-decker exhibits with food and everything, but those grew over the years once the auto company realized, holy cow, this is really a pretty big, significant show. It got more elaborate. '89, the price of a charity preview ticket was $50, and that grew up of about $450, at least $400, in the early 2000s.
Yeah,
and then got cut back during the great crash of 2008-2009. Got cut back to $250 for like 2 or 3 years, and now it's creeping back up. I think it's back up to $350 or $400 now.
Well, those were shaky years during the recession for sure, but it hung in there. And what do you think the future is now, especially with the new look at Cobo?
Well, the new look, it really looks, I mean, what they've done with the atrium really looks great, and they've sort of destroyed the old arena, and which has created some logistical issues for these couple of years of transition, because Ford used to use the old Cobo Arena for its presentations, and last year, maybe the year before too, has been doing them in Joe Louis Arena. So they got a pathway all set up for the press to walk, but it's a little hoofing to get over there, and it's a monster show, and in a very big industry, and it's they got a lot better electronics and just services. They used to have some issues with the union laborers. You'd get charged an extraordinary sum to move a cable from here to there, and they've done away with a bit of that gouging over the years. They said, hey, this can't cut it anymore, and of course the convention center now is run by a regional board. It's not owned by the city anymore, as
right,
it was in
right.
Coleman Young's day, and it seems, knock wood, to be doing pretty well. And
it all fits in. Well, it certainly seems like Heinz Prechter's brainstorm all those years ago certainly has paid off in terms of prestige and image, and certainly dollars and cents.
Absolutely, and they say they've done some of those economic impact studies that tend to show about $360 million worth of economic impact from the one show. I was talking to the general manager of the what is now called the Crown Plaza Pontchartrain Hotel, right across the street from Cobo, and this was the old Ponch.
Yep.
in the old days of Detroit, but it had been closed down for like 6 years and had been up and down since then, and seen better days. But the new owners came in, put $20 million into it, put a Crown Plaza flag on it, and got some nice first floor presentation and exhibit space. And I was the French auto supplier Forcia has rented it out to do a nice big fancy display right across the street, so it can entertain its customers there. And I guess Lear Corporation, the auto supplier, is doing a big reception there on charity preview night. So lots of nice spillover businesses for local hotels, which are all booked for that whole week. And it's hopefully we'll get better weather this week than we just went through last week.
Fingers crossed. Detroit Free Press business columnist Tom Walsh. Thanks so much, Tom. Good talking with you.
All right. Take care.
Well, that polar vortex did more than leave all of us shivering last week in those spectacularly frigid temps. It's also affecting the Great Lakes. MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who runs the website farmerweather.com, joins us. So, Mark, what did those Arctic temps do to the lakes?
Well, it started to cool it down faster. The Great Lakes normally cool down through the winter, and normally by first week in February in a normal winter, the lakes have slushed over, but this will cool it down faster, which will have effect on the lake effect snow.
How so?
Once the lakes get cool enough, and even if they don't freeze over altogether, if they get cool enough and down to 32 and kind of slushy, then the moisture given off for lake effect snow goes down to nothing, and we'll see the lake effect snow drop off.
Which something tells me drivers are not going to complain about.
Probably not. And it typically does happen every year. Typically we'll see it in February, like I said, when the lakes are the coldest, that even the cold air coming across the lakes then doesn't pick up the moisture. Now there's like one nice, real nice feature of when the lakes get cold, and that is increased sunshine.
Really? Then why is that?
Because the whole lake effect process makes clouds first and then snow next, and once the lakes get really cold, and if they could freeze all the way over, you won't have that moisture. And so we'll be like Wisconsin on a cold day, where they're cold and sunny, we'll be cold and sunny, and you'll notice that. I think in the next few weeks, you'll notice a little bit of an increase in sunshine. I'm not saying you're going to be out there sunbathing, but you'll notice that there will be a few more sunny days. And that's typical of late January into February. And then the lakes warm up a little bit and March turns kind of cloudy once again. Now, here's the downside of having cold lakes and ice on the lakes.
All right.
We don't have the warming effect. So, for example, when the polar vortex was down here last week, and let's say Grand Rapids had a low of -2. You went on the other side of the lake, Milwaukee, had lows in the minus 20s. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So once the lakes get cold enough, we won't have that insulating effect, and you'll also see if there are any more cold snaps, which I think there are a couple at least, late January and February, we can actually be colder in those places where the water normally keeps you a little bit milder.
So we can expect a reduction in lake effect snow. We can expect more sunshine, but we might be pulling on the extra heavy clothing if we get colder.
Yes, and then the last effect would be that a frozen lake evaporates less, so we could keep 1 or 2 inches more of water on the lake surface this winter versus a warm winter, and that helps us when we're out boating next summer.
That's what I wondered. So could we see an effect when the weather gets warm?
Usually it balances out pretty quickly. I mean, once the ice melts, there's usually not much of an effect.
But no one's going to complain with a couple of extra inches of water.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's just one piece of the lake level puzzle, and all the other pieces are pointing toward higher water, the biggest piece being precipitation, and that has been abundant across the Great Lakes, across the Lake Michigan, Lake Superior drainage basin in the last 3 months. And I got a feeling that we are going to be very surprised at if we don't gain another 6 to 8 inches of water this coming summer over what we had last year, and that would put it at almost 3 years now of increasing levels.
You've been awfully right with everything so far. Your credibility is very high with us, Mark Torregrossa.
All right, good.
Let's
keep that while it lasts. Mother Nature will mess it up at some point.
There you go. MLI meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also runs a website, farmerweather.com. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.